From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, House Democrats are expected to vote today on a resolution condemning hate speech after one of their own made comments that some call anti-Semitic.
She didn't have a full appreciation of how they landed on other people, where these words have a history and a cultural impact that might have been unknown to her.
Also today, as the Ivy League gets more diverse, Harvard professor Anthony Jack argues elite colleges are failing their disadvantaged students.
You cannot just admit students and be like, okay, our job is done. Because you have invited students, you have extended these coveted invitations, but you have not done the work. Colleges have not done the work to prepare for their arrival.
And a new book on the Irish Troubles investigates an unsolved murder and reveals for the first time who may have pulled the trigger. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. We begin with a jam-packed news day in the nation's capital, where House Democrats are expected to vote soon on a resolution condemning hate speech. This after one of their own, Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, tweeted remarks that some consider anti-Semitic. Also, former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort will be sentenced this hour for bank and tax fraud. All this with Washington reeling from the revelation that Senator Martha McSally, the first female fighter pilot to fly in combat, was raped during her time in the military. WBUR senior Washington news correspondent Kimberly Atkins is in the Capitol and joins me now. Hi there, Kimberly.
Hi there.
Let's start with the Democrats' resolution on hate speech, and I'll just fill in some quick background. Omar recently criticized Israel supporters for a, quote, allegiance to a foreign country. She previously said that support for Israel is a, quote, all about the Benjamins, as in money. Some accuse her of using anti-Semitic tropes about greed and disloyalty to the United States. So Omar is the reason for today's action in the House, but we heard Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, say earlier today that the resolution won't single her out.
It should not mention her name, and that's what we're working on, something that is one resolution addressing these forms of hatred, not mentioning her name, because it's not about her. It's about these forms of hatred.
So, Kimberly, if Ilhan Omar's name is not in the resolution, what do we know about what is in this resolution?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This resolution goes out of its way to condemn all forms of bigotry. It talks about anti-Semitism, but it also talks about anti-Muslim sentiment. It talks about bigotry against minorities. And it mentions even some specific instances, such as the Charlottesville rally in 2017 and last year's attack at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pennsylvania. It sort of tries to condemn all forms of hatred. It does not name Congresswoman Omar specifically. And it's done, it seems, in a way to get as much support, as many yes votes as they possibly can on this measure after the first draft of it, which was not as broad, caused a lot of members of the Democratic caucus to push back earlier this week.
Right. And one of the people who pushed back early on that narrower version of the draft was our own Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. She's been skeptical of this resolution. She's defended Omar. What's her argument, Kimberly?
Yes. I mean, she pointed out a few things, and she and other lawmakers have done this, too. She's not alone in saying, look, there has to be space within the caucus to discuss issues. In this case, I think there is a fear that anyone who questions U.S.-Israel relations will be tagged with the label of anti-Semitism and then will somehow be rebuked for that. Congresswoman Pressley also points out the fact that Congresswoman Omar has been the target, she and her family have been the target of really strong anti-Muslim sentiment even before she took office, and that is just as big of a problem than anything that this resolution was, anything that prompted this resolution. So there is a sense, look, in this case, it's different than other claims of bigoted statements because it does involve a policy, a U.S.-Israel policy. This is right in the purview of members of Congress to address and deal with. And there is a concern that there will be less room in order to speak about that issue without being tagged as a bigot.
And Kimberly, I understand that you caught up with another member of the Massachusetts delegation before coming on air. That was Congresswoman Catherine Clark. What did she have to say?
Yes, Congresswoman Clark, who is vice chair of the caucus, so clearly deeply involved in all of this, she made the point that, look, discussing these issues are important. Discussing anti-Semitism and other forms of bigotry is important. It's difficult. It can be uncomfortable. But she praised Democrats for being the ones who were having this tough these tough conversations. She pointed to President Trump, someone who is accused on a regular basis of saying things that are hateful, that are bigoted, misogynist, anti-Semitic, and other things. And the Republican caucus is really not holding him accountable, she said, at least on the Democratic side, as difficult as it is, at least they're having this conversation.
I see. So there's some overlap there in the arguments that we heard from Presley as well. And Kimberly, it just feels like the Democratic Party is sort of struggling right now with how and when to reprimand their own in the age of Trump, right? I mean, do they just stand on principle and say what's wrong is wrong, or do you engage in a sort of whataboutism game, right? Well, what about what President Trump has said? I mean, can you give us some perspective on the political calculations at play right now?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think President Trump is sort of looming over all of this. I think these conversations would be different if he weren't in office and there wasn't that comparison being made. You see a lot of people who are very upset, including Congresswoman Presley, who specifically has said not just the words of President Trump, but the policies of President Trump. She called racist and bigoted, particularly his immigration policies, and that it was a real problem when you're focusing on something like this, when those things are playing out at the same time. It's really difficult not to make those comparisons given what's going on.
One other big story in Washington right now, Kimberly, we mentioned at the top that this hour, Paul Manafort's sentencing hearing will begin. He faces up to 24 years for bank and tax fraud. And we've heard the White House say over and over that these crimes have nothing to do with the president. But realistically, I mean, can President Trump escape any political cost if his former campaign chair is behind bars?
You're exactly right. Look, the president has tried so hard. He's all but said he'd never met Paul Manafort before. As soon as Paul Manafort got into hot water, he said, well, he only worked for the campaign for a short period of time, didn't play a major role. Of course, he was the chairman. He was the chairman of the campaign as it went to the convention ahead of what had thought was going to be a challenge on the convention floor to Trump's nomination. So, yes, it will be difficult for him to separate himself from whatever befalls Paul Manafort, who clearly seems to be heading to prison, likely for the rest of his life.
That's WBUR senior Washington News correspondent Kimberly Adkins. Kimberly, thanks for your time today.
Anytime.
All right, turning to another big story in Washington, Senator Martha McSally, an Arizona Republican, delivered a powerful personal testimony yesterday when speaking to the House, to the Senate's Armed Services Subcommittee.
I am also a military sexual assault survivor. But unlike so many brave survivors, I didn't report being sexually assaulted. Like so many women and men, I didn't trust the system at the time. I blame myself. I was ashamed and confused. I thought I was strong, but felt powerless.
McSally was the first female fighter pilot in the country to fly in combat. Joining us now is former Massachusetts Representative Nikki Tsongas, who made fighting sexual assault in the military a priority during her time in Congress. Congresswoman Tsongas, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's so good to be with you.
Well, so as I just said, I mean, this was a big priority of yours while you were in Congress, and I just wonder what was going through your mind when you heard Senator McSally talk about her experience yesterday.
Well, I give her great credit. Given her role as a United States Senator, to bring her all the power that represents to this issue by telling her own personal story, her experiences as she sought to serve our country, I think does great honor to all those survivors who come from more modest situations, who fought so hard to be heard, and to now have her be a voice for them as well as for her own experiences, I think is so important to the issue.
Well, the awful reality is that McSally is far from alone. According to a Pentagon report last April, there were more than 6,700 sexual assaults reported in the military in 2017. That's actually a 10% increase from the previous year. And among those who reported an assault, 58% said they faced some sort of backlash within their unit. So, Congressman Tsongas, I mean, we know that maybe this is a higher reporting rate, not necessarily a higher incidence rate, but it's still alarming. And why is it so hard to make progress on this issue?
Well, it's definitely a work in progress. I think it requires a culture change as much as we've initiated and instituted a lot of reform. So, for example, the survey itself is a reflection of some of the work we've done so that we won't be blindsided on a sort of arbitrary basis with information about how often these assaults are occurring. We've worked very hard to bring more transparency to it so that we members of Congress can continue to address it in the specific ways where we see shortcomings. So you have to hope that the survey itself is bringing a more regular oversight to these crimes themselves, the issue, and that in some instances that the other reforms we put in place around the Uniform Code of Military Justice, retaliation itself is now a crime, not a simple crime to prove, but nevertheless a crime, that all of these reforms are encouraging people to come forward, that the numbers themselves, I hope, have stabilized, but that more people are more willing to bring their claims forward because they have more trust in the system. I think Senator McSally even alluded to that. She was a member of the House Armed Services Committee as we moved ahead on legislation on a yearly basis. And my hope is that were she in that terrible situation today, she would have more confidence to move forward. But the reality is that this is a work in progress. There's much work to do. There is a Military Sexual Assault Prevention Caucus. I co-chaired that. It's now with the Congressman Mike Turner from Ohio. There is a co-chair now from California that will continue to work with him. So this is a issue that will be addressed on an ongoing basis, but clearly still work to be done.
McSally did indicate the changing attitudes were one of the reasons why she's willing to talk about this now. I want to play one more piece of tape from that hearing yesterday. You know, she said that she initially resisted telling anybody about what had happened to her, but when it seemed like the military was actually going to be serious about fixing this problem, she decided to come forward.
I was horrified at how my attempt to share generally my experiences were handled. I almost separated from the Air Force at 18 years over my despair. Like many victims, I felt the system was raping me all over again.
So, Congresswoman Tsongas, I mean, how typical is that experience, both the initial reluctance to come forward out of that fear and also the new attitude that perhaps the system is beginning to work?
I think it's very common. You know, I describe this as a series of betrayals. So, first of all, you have young women and men who seek to serve their country, go to war if necessary, and end up being betrayed and grievously harmed by their own. That is the initial searing betrayal that they experience. Then the command structure historically would too often turn a blind eye or not take it seriously or not know how to take it seriously. So that was another betrayal. Then because of the nature of the units and the sort of need for cohesion and everybody working together, too often peers would retaliate simply to those who came forward, blaming the victim rather than holding accountable the perpetrator. And then we saw all too often the many ways in which the Uniform Code of Military Justice just did not bring justice to survivors or hold perpetrators accountable. So we initiated some really important reforms there. And then finally, as too many victims transitioned to veteran status, they found that the VA was too unprepared, completely unprepared, actually, to deal with the aftermath of these assaults. So the work has been on all these fronts, and I'm glad to hear that Senator McSally and hopefully other survivors, you know, are finding a system that's more open to their complaints and encourages people to come forward, because we can't change it if it remains invisible. We simply can't. And so there's hope there. But obviously, as I said, we can't stop working at it until we just don't see these kinds of numbers.
That's former Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
It's been more than 6 months since an overpressurized gas line exploded in the Merrimack Valley, causing millions of dollars in damage and taking the life of an 18-year-old. Now, dozens of small business owners say Columbia Gas, the company responsible for the explosions, hasn't come close to covering their losses. One of those small business owners is Eusebio Jr. Hernandez, who owns a convenience store called Hernandez Market in Lawrence. Jr., thanks for speaking with Radio Boston.
Thank you very much for having me.
What has happened since the September explosions? What kinds of losses has your business suffered?
Since September 13th, what occurred here in the city was something tragic. My problem was the business interruption part, which when they shut off the electricity to half the city, I have lost, you know, everything from my dairy products to all the meats.
And I understand you had to close down for some 50 days. That must have taken quite a toll on revenue.
Yes, that's another part. We had to close down. I mean, at the beginning, where it was all mandatory through the city because we had to, you know, disinfect and clean and get rid of all the spoilage.
I realize it's impossible to know for sure how much you would have made during those days, but ballpark, what do you figure your losses amount to at this point?
Probably tens of thousands of dollars.
Tens of thousands. And what have you received so far from Columbia Gas?
Well, the thing is, I prefer to keep that private because I'm working with a lawyer.
But you would say, I take it, that it is not enough to cover what you believe you have lost.
No, actually, my business right now, it's not doing too good. I might be closing my doors in a couple of months, 3 to 4 months, if I don't get help.
What about the argument, though, that, you know, Columbia Gas has paid out claims to businesses like yours? It may not cover everything that you've lost, but they're making some progress, and you need to just be patient.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I am aware of that. They've done help me out. You know, they have paid me out for, you know, loss and spoilage. But the thing is, it's not coming fast enough. It's too much red tape, you know, and we need the help now so we could keep the doors open.
Junior, do you have a theory why business has been slower since you've been able to reopen? Is it just a matter of, you know, in the 50 days that you were closed, perhaps your customers just found other places to shop and have stayed with it? Or maybe they're hurting themselves and just don't have as much money to spend?
Right. I think it's a lot of things put together. I think it's that. I think it's a lot of people is hurting. A lot of people have moved out of my neighborhood because of the event.
You know, Junior, we spoke earlier today with Joe Bevilacqua, who is the president of the Merrimack Valley Chamber of Commerce. He said part of the struggle that your business and others could be having right now is just the cold weather. I mean, what do you make of that? Does that explain it or not entirely?
No, I don't think so. I've been here 9 years, and I never been what I'm going through now on a winter. I'm the only store in my neighborhood that makes a borderline between North Andover and Lawrence. So I have a lot of foot traffic. You jump on 495, and I'm not seeing it.
And do you know how common your experience is? I mean, you're feeling it at Hernandez Market, but I'm sure that you talk to other businesses within Lawrence. Are others feeling the same kind of pain that you are?
Yes, there's a lot of businesses in Lawrence that are suffering right now. I have a friend of mine that he's still closed. He's on South Union. It's Papi's Grocery. He's still closed. He hasn't opened his doors yet.
And we have just received a statement from Columbia Gas, and I'll read part of it. It says that each of these claims is unique, and we work with each individual customer to assist them in gathering and providing the information we need to make payments on reasonable claims as quickly as possible. Do you take any comfort in that, Junior, or are you not holding your breath?
It's a hit and miss for me. I mean, I've been trying to reach out to Columbia Gas. I have submitted papers. I've submitted everything what they have asked me. Maybe some other business have better luck than I have. I know there's other business that have worse luck.
And just to put some numbers on it, Columbia Gas has said that there are about 200 business claims that remain active as of this week. It says it's already paid out 2,400 business claims worth about $29 million. So that is a lot of money, Junior, but you're saying that there's still a lot of work to be done.
Yes, there's still a lot of work to be done. I believe, you know, if making a strong point would be probably advertisement, you know, coming down here themselves and you know, knowing exactly what's going on, you know, in each neighborhood and each business, you know, exactly what do you need? How can we help you move forward? How can we make you whole? What exactly do you need?
So a lot still to come. That's Eusebio Junior Hernandez, owner of Hernandez Market in Lawrence. Best of luck to you, Junior. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. What does it mean to be a poor student on a rich campus? That question is at the center of a new book by Anthony Jack, an assistant professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. In the book, The Privileged Poor: How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students, Jack peels back complex layers of poverty, privilege, and inclusion. Elite universities, he writes, bend over backwards to admit disadvantaged students, but then once the students are there, they maintain policies that not only remind those students of their disadvantage, but even serve to highlight it. Anthony Jack joins me now in studio. Welcome to Radio Boston, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
So can we just start with a real basic question? Can you explain what you mean by the privileged poor? The phrase sounds like a contradiction.
It's an oxymoron. It's purposely so. I want people to ask that exact question. How can someone be both privileged and poor? And it came up in my research that one half of the lower income black students, like myself, actually graduate from boarding day and preparatory high schools like Andover and Exeter. And so even though we come from impoverished backgrounds, we were very low income. Our parents tend to not have gone to college and work in low-wage jobs. We got access to private schools, but not just the private schools, but the experiences, the educational experience of the top 1%. Some schools allow study abroad programs. You have friends who come from very wealthy families, and sometimes you also get invited on those private jets or those summer vacations or those, you're the beneficiary of more than just the academic training that those schools provide. And so in some ways, like, they're privileged in that sense. And so I put them together, kind of like privileged poor, kind of invites that question, how can someone be both privileged and poor?
I see. And so you're sort of lumping yourself into that category. And fill us in a little bit. You told our Carrie Young recently that the neighborhood you grew up in was one that people would drive through sort of quickly, but you did also graduate from a selective private high school.
I did. When I was in high school, I'm a Head Start kid, and I went to public school my entire life. But my 11th grade year, I encountered a coach that wanted you to be an athlete student, not a student athlete. And that eventually led me to leave the school. And so I got a scholarship to Gulliver Preparatory in Miami. And that one year was like a boot camp for what Amherst College, which is where I went to undergrad, ended up being. I got introduced to wealth and privilege in a way that I did not see growing up. And in one respects, I heard the term hostel for the first time. And I had never heard, you know, people going around Europe and staying in these type of places. And backpacking through Europe was even something that was brand new to me. So I learned a lot. But also academically, there was something there, too, because I got introduced to office hours, even though the school didn't necessarily use the same exact terms. Teachers had to make themselves available to us 1 hour every day after school. And it was drilled in us that we should make use of that time. When I got to Amherst, I saw the exact same thing. And so a lot of it was, there were a lot of parallels between the two.
I see. So I'm glad you brought up the office hours term, because this is something you write about in the book that stood out to me. And maybe not so much for the privileged poor students, but for the doubly disadvantaged, which is another group that you tackle. You told the story about some of those students not knowing what the term meant. In fact, assuming the opposite. The office hours meant that's when the professor is in his or her office and not to be disturbed.
Yeah, no, it's true. Office hours, like many things on a college campus, is a very classed term. You probably heard the term office hours if you fall in one of three categories. Either your parents went to college, you went to a certain type of high school, or you took one of those, how can I put it? You had access to some kind of program that previewed it for you, either at one of the boarding schools, like doing a summer program or doing different things like that. And so office hours like fellowship and internship and even syllabus, some of the most things that we take for granted are very, very class terms. And one of the examples that I use in the book is that at one college, a professor asked students, like, hey, why don't you visit me in my office hours? And the students actually responded, well, you told us that your office hours are from 2 to 4. That's the time that you should not be bothered because you're doing your work, right? And so it was something that was lost in translation that had nothing to do with, like, English proficiency. It was something that these terms have operated on these college campuses, which are silos, right? Because not everyone has access to them, that when you bring in new students, non-traditional students, or however you want to frame it, there's a certain type of learning curve for both the institution as well as the students. And oftentimes the institution doesn't want to change to accommodate those new admits.
And a simple misunderstanding of a term like that can have real consequences, right? Because, you know, part of the college experience is not only the in-class education you get, but it's also the networking, the social capital that you build when you leave. And if you're missing out on those opportunities because you misunderstand the term office hours, that sets you back.
Yeah. I mean, the question is, you know, I can write a letter of recommendation for a student who got an A in my class, and it could probably just say this person got an A in my class. But if a student comes to my office hours, I get to know the student on a personal level, why they want to take the class, why they came to college, what are their interests, and they serve as my research assistant. And then over time, they also, like, you know, watch my cats when I go on vacation or something like that, and they get to know me personally, I get to know them. Their letter looks very different. The example that I love to use is like the Rhodes Scholarship. You need upwards of 8 letters of recommendation to apply for that prestigious fellowship. How many people can actually say, I have 8 people, not only who can write for me, but who can write a very strong letter detailing my character, my work ethic, and my intellectual abilities in that letter? Like, and that may be, you know, a unique example, but this is the road to not only letters of recommendations and invitations to be someone's research assistant, but it's also when you need emotional support, when you need someone to go to bat for you because you had a misstep, right? To give you the benefit of the doubt. That is office hours, or connections with faculty more generally, is the road to those type of connections.
I want to ask you about another example you use in the book. And I should say that you interviewed more than 100 students, right, at selective colleges for this. So you got a pretty good sample pool here. And one of the ones that stood out to me among the so-called privileged poor had to do with dining halls and school breaks. Fill me in on what that was all about.
Yeah, I think dining halls highlight the dining hall closures specifically highlight the difference between access and inclusion. Many universities have opened their campuses and offered generous financial aid packages. But those same universities, which I found only 1 in 5, actually keep their dining halls open during spring or Thanksgiving or different kind of recesses that colleges have.
And the assumption is, right, that our students they're going home or they're going on vacation.
Right. So they're going on vacation, they're going home for turkey during Thanksgiving, or they're going for fun in the sun during spring break. And the reality is many students become food insecure during those breaks. They have no idea where their next meal is coming from. And what students do is they make tough decisions about how to make ends meet. So some students, as one student told me, I go to Family Dollar and buy everything that I can afford that I can then microwave because he doesn't have a fridge to put his food in. Or some students steal food from their own dining halls, oftentimes with the help of cafeteria workers, to actually be able to have something to live off of or to bridge the gap between what they can buy and what they can steal. And that's literally built into the very structure of the college calendar.
So what's causing the cup to miss the lip here? I mean, in other words, you're getting the students onto your campus in the first place, but you're saying the infrastructure, the way the campus runs, isn't built for students who don't come from affluent families or families where their parents have gone to college. So are there some basic recommendations that could solve that issue?
I mean, there are some basic things, but I think what we really need to do is we need to question what we take for granted. I think universities, especially selective universities, have been so long catered to wealthy people from wealthy families, and then when they did diversify, they typically diversified from students who went to wealth by admitting students who went to wealthy schools, both who are full pay and full scholarship. So they are slower than they should be in making that move from, again, access to inclusion, making intentional steps to not only promote belonging, but making sure that students make the most of their time. And some things as basic as one, as I will keep saying until I turn blue in the face, is defining office hours, because I think that puts people in a position to start thinking, and I hope anyone who reads my work begins to ask themselves, what else do we take for granted? Right. If we keep throwing around terms like office hours, but I met someone who had taught for 25 years and he said, you know what, Tony, I never thought about actually taking that step and saying what I'm talking about. I always just say when they are. Right. And so those kind of moments. And yes, something as simple as opening the dining halls during break is another step. But there are many other things that we need to do, because I think colleges also need to understand just the prevalence of food and housing insecurity. So we actually didn't know how many of our students are food and housing insecure, because it's a growing number. And Sarah Goetrob at Temple found that 2 out of 5 of our students, undergraduates across the country, are food insecure. So what does that actually mean? And then we actually have more and more colleges that need to actually study not just how prevalent the problem is, but what is the nature of it? Because I show that it can be episodic, happening around breaks, or it could be chronic. And that actually requires 2 different policy changes to address it. Food banks can address one versus openings and more university-wide things can address the other.
And in your work, what did you find is the effect on graduation? Because there can be, it's sort of 2 levels, right? I mean,
right.
It can be you come on and it can be the degree to which you feel comfortable on campus. And then there's the matter of whether you can actually finish and get that degree. What did you find?
Right. So I study schools where the graduation rates tend to be pretty high. And so the question is, we actually don't know how food and housing insecurity shapes academic performance and or graduation rates. So we are only beginning to open this kind of like Pandora's box to actually see if we can find out what is hurting students. Because we think that just because students are getting in and getting in under these conditions, that they're going to be okay. And then we realize, like, how many of these this hidden curriculum that students have to engage, these unset rules and unset and hidden expectations that trip students up. But they also have these official policies that they have to confront, like the closing of dining halls, that really does undercut their ability to be full functioning people. And so we're only now beginning to get a sense of how these problems are affecting students, which is why the GAO released their report looking at all the studies and all the surveys on food insecurity to actually see what we can do as a nation, as a national policy level, to fix this problem.
What do you say, though, to the skeptic who looks at your own personal story and says, but look, your own success shows that the hurdles must not be so bad, right? Because you got through Amherst. You're a Harvard professor now. You overcame all those hurdles.
Yeah, my story highlights more poverty than privilege, though. If you think about the ways in which it highlights just how many obstacles that one person has to overcome. It shouldn't be patting ourselves on the back saying, oh, look, this one person did it. It was just like, why are the obstacles so high? And look at how many other students did not do it. Right. And so we have to look at how poverty and inequality shapes not only the path to college, but also the path through. And I hope that my research, even though I study the elites, pushes us to think about how education policy has to be about neighborhood inequality, has to be about school inequality before we even get to the post-secondary education aspects of it, because we've disinvested a lot in how we fund how we support our neighborhoods and how we support our schools.
Did you see peers who were just as gifted as you not make it through the way you did?
Yes, I think I'm the only person in my Head Start class, I think, who finished college, or at least went on.
You, in the book, use the sort of catch-all phrase renowned university, perhaps not to single out any one university, but you are focusing on sort of the upper echelon there. I'm curious, what is the reason for that? Because the other thing folks might wonder is, well, what about the students, you know, they're at state schools or they're at those middle-tier schools? Why overlook them?
I'm not overlooking them. I actually take time throughout the book to show how not only these problems are prevalent at our state colleges, regional colleges, and even community colleges, but I also want to show this. If I'm at a campus where they have removed money as a hurdle to entry, they have also removed like a lot of the things that push students to drop out, like working off campus and the like. If I'm showing that these problems exist in this environment, what do you think happens at a community college? What do you think happens at a state college where the resources are fewer and the attempts to be high touch in that way of working with students is not actually there because it can't be there? Like, those are the gaps. Like, I'm highlighting this at a place where you don't even expect it to be. Did you really expect food insecurity at a school like Yale and Harvard and Dartmouth and Smith and places like that? No. And so the fact that I'm highlighting it at these places hopefully draws attention to what is the reality at other campuses as well.
That's Anthony Jack. He's an assistant professor of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and a junior fellow at the Harvard Society of Fellows. His new book is called The Privileged Poor: How Elite Colleges Are Failing Disadvantaged Students. Professor Jack, thanks for being with us on Radio Boston.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Dorchester native Patrick Radden Keefe's new book takes place across the pond, but it certainly hits home. It's called Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. It's about the 1972 disappearance of Jean McConville, a single mother of 10, during the period of nationalist and religious violence known as the Troubles. Keefe not only attempts to solve McConville's kidnapping and murder, but also captures the trauma felt by an entire culture. And he does it with the help of a rich and controversial archive at Boston College. Patrick Radden Keefe, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good to be with you.
So I know you're a native son. You grew up in Dorchester in the heart of Boston's Irish community, but you've written that it's actually not your childhood that attracted you to the story. So what did?
Well, so my day job is I'm a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, and I write these big, sprawling narrative pieces. And so I'm always casting about looking for ideas. And in 2013, I read an obituary in The New York Times for a woman named Dolores Price, who had been the first woman to join the IRA as a full frontline soldier. And she lived this very dramatic life. And one of the details in this obituary was that she had been implicated in this famous crime from 1972 when this mother of 10, Jean McConville, was abducted in front of her children and taken away and shot and disappeared. The kids never knew what happened to her. She was buried in a secret grave. So the way this started for me, you know, I'd been aware of the Troubles growing up, certainly in Dorchester. But my real interest here came from that obituary and the idea that you could look at the stories of these two women, one a victim and one a perpetrator, and try and tell a larger story about the history of the Troubles.
Yeah, and you really bring Dolores Price to life, Patrick. You know, the bedtime story in my house last night was The Little Engine That Could. In her house, it was something different, very different. Could you fill us in?
Yeah, so she came from a long line of Irish Republicans. Her father had been in the IRA. She had relatives on both sides who'd been in the IRA going back generations. So when she and her sister Marion were little, their father, Albert Price, who was a famous longtime IRA guy, would sit them on his lap, and he would tell them bedtime stories about when he was young and, you know, he was locked up in Derry jail and he broke out, or the time that he went to London on a bombing mission. And he would tell them as little girls, he would tell them the recipe for mixing improvised explosives, and you have to do it with wooden utensils because otherwise they'll blow up. So this was the atmosphere that these two young girls were raised in.
Just normal fatherly advice there.
Yeah. Exactly, exactly.
And so, you know, Dolores and Marion Price might have taken any involvement in the disappearance of Jean McConville to their graves, except that Dolores participated in this oral history project at Boston College. So fill us in on that. And how did those records come to light? Because they were meant to stay secret.
Exactly. So, the you know, the book is called Say Nothing, and that's from a Seamus Heaney poem, Whatever You Say, Say Nothing. And I think probably some of your listeners who share my heritage might, you know, might appreciate that there's an element in Irish culture in which certain things are left unsaid. And this was particularly true during the Troubles, when there was a real code of silence, particularly around paramilitary activity. So after the Good Friday Agreement in 1998 puts an end to the conflict, Boston College, which had long roots, you know, tying it back to Ireland, decided to do something to commemorate the end of the Troubles. And a decision was made to start a secret archive. And the idea was, you have all these paramilitaries who otherwise would take their stories to their graves. Let's create a situation in which they can talk about the things they did and be really candid about the worst years of the conflict. And, you know, the things they were talking about in many instances are war crimes and crimes where there's no statute of limitations. So you had to do it in secret because otherwise nobody would talk, right? They would worry that the cops would get their hands on these recordings. So what BC did was the promise that was made was essentially come on in, tell your stories at great length. You know, people would come in and talk for 10, 12, 15 hours. And we'll put it in a time capsule until you die. And, you know, we'll keep it top secret. It was all going to be kept in Chestnut Hill under the strictest secrecy and only released after the deaths of these people. And that was a promise that it turned out BC couldn't keep. And so part of what the book is about is that this all unraveled in a pretty spectacular fashion. A lot of people came in and did tell their stories. But in around 2010, 2011, word started to leak out about this archive. And at that point, the authorities in Northern Ireland said, wait a second, so in Boston, there's an archive of people who are still alive talking about the atrocities that they committed during the Troubles. Couldn't we get our hands on that? And that's what they proceeded to do.
And I understand that you weren't able to get your hands on the entire archive, at least not directly from BC, but that other sources were able to give you material that helped to form the basis of the book and helped you investigate this kidnapping and murder of Jean McConville. So without totally spoiling the book, Patrick, fill us in on what you were able to discover that's new.
Yeah, so look, I mean, the approach that I wanted to take in this book was not the approach you would take in writing a history book. I wanted to treat this almost more like a novel, that I was looking at the lives of a half a dozen people, and I really wanted to be as vivid as I could in terms of understanding them and all their complexity. So it's people like Dolores Price, Jean McConville, Gerry Adams is a big character in the book. And I learned a lot about what had happened to Jean McConville, in part because I did get hold of one of the one complete Boston College transcript, and then the transcript of another unpublished interview that had been in that collection as well. But there was this one stubborn mystery, which was who it was that actually pulled the trigger. So, you know, somebody killed Jean McConville, and when they squeezed that trigger, they made 10 orphans because she was a widow. And very late in the game, I figured out who that person was, and it's somebody who's still alive and had not been identified before. And so I made the difficult decision, in consultation with a bunch of lawyers, as you can imagine, to publish the name in the book.
Well, so how about that? Because you talk about that sort of culture of silence. It's right in the title of the book. It's sort of contrary, I'm sure, to your DNA as a journalist. But is that something you wrestled with? It sounds like you did a little bit. You know, how much do you reveal here? Are some secrets better left buried? Or as a reporter, do you just, you know, tell what you know?
Yeah, you know, I tend to to be pretty dogmatic about telling what I know, I tend not to pull a lot of punches because I feel as though when you're doing that, it stops being journalism at a certain point. And I should say, different people play different roles, right? So accountability is one question. I mean, there are things that I write about in the book that maybe people should be prosecuted for. It's not my business. You know, maybe there's the evidence there, maybe there isn't. I'm not a prosecutor. It's not what I do. My job is to go out and uncover the truth as best I can. And I feel as though that's an important thing. And I think that in Northern Ireland and in other places, you know, you can try and brush the past under the rug. You can try and bury the past, but it won't stay buried.
So we do have a little bit of archive sound of Dolores Price. This is not from her BC interviews, but it's from a documentary called I, Dolores, that came out last year. And she was talking to a filmmaker about how she viewed informants who maybe included Jean McConville. At least that was the allegation at the time.
I certainly advocated that informers should be thrown out. Their bodies should be thrown out on the street to put the fear of God and the Republican movement into anybody who would choose that form of life.
So you see there the scare tactic that the kidnapping of Jean McConville was, right? I mean, the accusation was that she was informing on the IRA and she needed to be an example of, Patrick.
Yeah, except that the difference there – well, I guess 2 points. One is that that yes, so the allegation was that Jean McConville had been informing and giving information to the British Army. Her children, who are all grown up today, have always really strenuously denied that. They've said this is wrong. She was a widowed mother of 10. You know, how could she be some super spy? What information could she have gleaned? I don't come down one way or the other in the book. I just present the evidence and let the reader draw their own conclusions. The interesting point that Dolores Price is making, though, is that normally what would have happened is if you have an informer, you would kill them and you'd dump them on the street. With Jean McConville, they disappeared her. And that was, I think, by most people's admission, and even Dolores Price, they would say it's a much worse thing to do, right? Because if you dump the body on the street, it's obviously a terrible, brutal thing to do to the family. But the family can bury the body, and they have a grave to visit, and they have some sense of closure. The problem for the McConville children and for others who had family members who were disappeared is you just don't know. You know, some of the children for years thought she would come back. They thought she might have gotten amnesia and wandered off. They didn't know what had happened. You know, there were rumors at the time that she might have just abandoned her children and run off with a soldier. So it's a very, very pernicious thing to do to the family members to disappear someone. And this is part of what was interesting to me about the case of Jean McConville. Obviously, 3,600 people died in the Troubles, right? I could have written a book like this about almost any of those cases. But this was such an extreme example.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real cruelty into that lack of closure there. And yet, Patrick Radenkeef, I was struck by times when it seemed like even the most villainous characters in your book have some kind of guilty conscience or something. You know, I'm thinking about even that really vivid scene at the beginning of your book about the night that Jean McConville is kidnapped. You know, she's being taken out of her home, and yet her kidnappers make sure that she puts on her jacket, you know, as if she's going to be cold or something. And then someone takes the time to return some of her belongings, right, a purse and some rings to her children, so they'll have some mementos. How do you see that? It was sort of a nuance to the story that was kind of surprising to me.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that because, look, one thing that I realized early on and that I very much wanted to capture in the book is that there aren't a lot of mustache-twirling villains in this story. By and large, this is about, you know, ordinary people who are thrust into extraordinary historical circumstances. And many of them did awful, awful things, but I think a lot of them had the humanity to see that those are awful things. And part of what the story is about is I wanted to look at a handful of people who in the early 1970s were really at the vanguard of the IRA and the Republican movement. And in service of the ideal, you know, we want to get the Brits out. They did some brutal, brutal things to themselves as well as to others. They went on hunger strike. You know, they killed people. And then I wanted to track them over the decades and see, well, how do you feel about those things? You know, it's one thing when you're in your late teens, early 20s, and it's the early 1970s. How do you feel later when you're in your 30s? How do you feel when you get out of prison? How do you feel when you get married and have children of your own? And it was fascinating because you can see these people, there's no daylight between them in the early 70s. But you check in on them in the late 90s, and they feel very differently, you know, from one person to the next about the things that they did as young people. So I wanted to try and see these people in their messy humanity, even in their, you know, their moments of kindness. There's an example in the book where there's a character, a guy named Kev McKee, who was another informant, who gets picked up and brought down to a house, and he's supposed to be executed. But they wait a few days, and there are these guys staying in the house with him, and they kind of like him. And he's a fun guy, and he can cook, and he can tell a joke. And when the time comes to kill him, they say, I can't do it. Can't bring myself to shoot him. And so they had to send for another team of gunmen from Belfast to come down and do it. So there are moments like that throughout where even in the height of the savagery of this conflict, you see these glimmers of humanity.
And while most of the book is looking back at history, it is a little bit forward-looking toward the end, Patrick, right? You look at the looming Brexit and how the irony might be that we might end up with a united Ireland in a way that the violent Troubles never could bring about.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, this is – it's very much – you know, a lot of the book takes place in the early 1970s, but the one idea that came back to me again and again is you go to Northern Ireland and the past is the present. They are living with the past all the time. So, you know, there's no real distinction between these two. In some ways, I think the funny thing about Brexit is I think voters in the UK sort of forgot about the Irish border and the Irish problem and the conflict and the Troubles when they made that vote. Not realizing that, you know, if you leave the European Union, then the only border, land border, between the UK and the EU is going to run right through Ireland. And I think they're discovering now that they forgot about that to their peril. The question of reunification is really interesting, right? Because I do think there's a chance, not in the near term, but in the long term, that if you force this situation in which the UK leaves the EU with all of the awful ramifications of that, you could create a situation in which you precipitate a scenario where people actually vote willingly. There's a referendum at some point, and you see the reunification of Ireland, which when you think about all the blood that was spilled in pursuit of that idea over three decades, it's pretty shocking to think that it might end up being an inadvertent consequence of Brexit.
It is indeed. Patrick Radden-Keefe's new book is called Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. He'll be speaking at 7 tomorrow night at the Harvard Bookstore. Patrick, thanks for being with us on Radio Boston.
Thank you.
One note on the way out. The Washington Post is reporting that debate on the anti-hate resolution has been postponed as House leaders make further changes to the resolution's language. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call, but give it a try. 617-917-4717.